Chapter 44 Palau Lagundi, Sunda Strait. Stepping carefully, they backed up a few feet and scanned the ground nearby. Anything? Sam asked. No. Hop onto that tree. If we haven't fallen through yet, we probably won't. Just humor me. Remy backed up until her butt bumped into the trunk, then turned and climbed onto the lowermost branch. Sam shrugged off his pack and laid it on the ground. Next, holding his stick parallel to the ground at waist height like a tightrope walker, he crept forward until he was standing over the tip of Remy's stick. He knelt down, placed his stick in front of his knees, then pulled Remy's free. He dug his headlamp from the thigh pocket of his cargo pants and shone the beam into the hole. "It's deep," he said. "Can't see the bottom." "What do you want to do?" "What I want to do is widen it and crawl down there, but it's almost dark. Let's set up camp and wait for daylight." They slept fitfully, passing the hours dozing and talking, their minds imagining what might lay only feet away from their hammock. Having both metaphorically and literally traced the same course Winston Blaylock followed during his quest, Sam and Remy felt as though they'd been hunting for the Shenandoah for years. They waited until enough morning sun was filtering through the canopy to partially light their work, then ate a quick breakfast and climbed back up the hillock to the hole left by Remy's stick, this time equipped with a 30-foot coil of nylon boating rope that had come with the Panisi. Remy looped one end of the line twice around the nearest tree. The opposite end of the line Sam formed into a makeshift horse collar that he slipped over his shoulders and tucked under his armpits. "Luck," said Remy. Sam paced over to the hole and knelt down. Carefully, he began jabbing with the stick, knocking chunks of loam and congealed ash into the unseen voids below, backing away on his knees as the hole widened. After 5 minutes' work, it was the size of a manhole. Sam stood up and called over his shoulder, "Have you got me?" Remy grabbed the line tighter, took in the slack, and braced her feet against the trunk. "I've got you." Sam coiled his knees and jumped a few inches off the ground. He did it again a little higher. He paused and looked around. "See any cracks?" "All clear." Sam stomped on the ground once, then again, then 6 times in quick succession. "I think we're okay." Remy tied off her end of the line and joined Sam at the hole. He unraveled the horse collar and knotted it around the strap on his headlamp, then clicked the lamp on and started lowering it into the hole, counting forearm lengths as he went. The line went slack. At the bottom of the hole, the headlamp lay on its side. They leaned forward and peered into the gloom. After a moment, Remy said, "Is that a... no, can't be. A skeleton foot? Yes, it can be." He looked up at her. "Tell you what. Why don't I go first?" "Great idea." After retrieving the headlamp, they spent a few minutes tying climbing knots in the rope, then dropped it back into the hole. Sam slid his feet into the opening, wiggled forward, and began lowering himself hand over hand. Like a geologist examining an exposed cliff face, Sam felt as though he were descending through history. The first layer of material was regular soil, but passing 2 more feet, the color changed, first to light brown, then a muddy gray. "I'm into the ash layer," he called. Clumps and veins of what appeared to be petrified wood and vegetation began appearing in the ash. His feet touched the bottom of the shaft he'd excavated from above. He kicked toeholds into the sides of the shaft and slowly transferred his weight to his legs until he was certain he was steady. Jutting from the side of the shaft was what they'd thought was a skeletal foot. "It's a tree root," he called. "Thank God." "Next one will probably be the real thing."
"I know."
"Stick, please." Remy lowered it down to him. Using both hands, he worked the stick first like a posthole digger, then like a pot stirrer, knocking and scraping at the shaft until he was satisfied with the width. Plumes of ash swirled around him. He waited for the cloud to settle, then squatted on his haunches and repeated the process until he'd opened 4 more feet of shaft. "How deep so far?" Remy called. 8 feet, give or take. Sam lifted the stick up and slid it into his belt. "We're going to have to evacuate this debris." "Hold on." A moment later, Remy called, "Bag coming down." One of their nylon stuff sacks landed on his head. Knotted to the drawstring was some paracord. Sam squatted down, filled the bag with the debris, and Remy hauled it up. 2 more times cleared the shaft. Sam began lowering himself again. Under the weight of the layers above, the mixture here had become more and more compressed until finally, at the 10-foot mark, the color morphed again, from gray to brown to black. Sam stopped suddenly. He felt his heart lurch. He turned his head sideways, trying to aim the headlamp's beam at what had caught his eye. He found it again, then braced his feet against the shaft's sides to steady himself. "I've got timber," he called. There were several seconds of silence, then Remy's faint voice. "I'm dumbfounded, Sam. Describe it." "It's a horizontal piece about 3 inches thick. I can see 8 to 10 inches of it."
3 inches thick is too thin to be the spar deck. Could it be the deckhouse roof? The only other raised structures were the stack, the engine room skylight, the wardroom skylight, and the wheelhouse. Do you see any traces of glass?"
"No. I'm moving on."
Again he reached the bottom of his excavation. They evacuated more debris, then he kicked out his toe holds and went to work with the stick. On his first strike, he heard the solid thunk of wood on wood. He did it again with the same result. He dug out the remainder of the shaft, then craned his neck downward, illuminating the bottom with his headlamp.
"I've got decking!" he shouted.
He lowered himself until his feet touched the deck. The wood creaked and bowed under his weight. After shoving debris to one side with his boot, he slammed his heel down and got a satisfying crack in reply. 12 more stomps opened a ragged 2-foot hole. The rest of the detritus plunged through the opening.
"I'm going through!"
Hand over hand, he lowered himself through the deck. The light from the surface receded and faded, leaving him suspended in the glow of his headlamp. His feet touched a hard surface. He tested his weight on it. It was solid. Cautiously, he released the rope.
"I'm down," he called. "Looks okay."
"I'm on my way," Remy replied. 2 minutes later, she was beside him. She clicked on her headlamp and illuminated the hole above their heads.
"That has to be the deckhouse roof."
"Which would make this the berth deck," said Sam. "And a tomb," they quickly realized, panning their beams around the space. Running down each side of the space at sporadic intervals were 20 or so hammocks hanging from the overhead. All of the hammocks were occupied. The remains were mostly skeletal, save patches of desiccated flesh on whatever body parts weren't covered in clothing.
"It's like they simply lay down and waited to die," said Remy.
"That's probably accurate," Sam replied. "Once the ship was buried, they had 3 choices: suffocation, starvation, or suicide. Let's move on. You choose." The only blueprints they'd seen for the ship had come from the original shipbuilder. They had no idea what, if any, changes either the Sultan of Zanzibar or Blaylock might have made to the interior layout. This berth deck seemed close to the original, but what about the rest of the ship? Remy chose forward and started walking. The deck was almost pristine. Had they not come in the way they had, it would have been impossible to tell they were under 14 feet of earth.
"Has to be the lack of oxygen," Remy said. "It's been hermetically sealed for 130 years.
Their beams swept over a wooden column blocking their path.
"The foremost?" Remy asked.
"Yes." On the other side of this, they found a bulkhead and 2 steps leading up into what had once been the petty officer's quarters. It had since been turned into a storage compartment for timber and sailcloth. Let's head aft, Sam said. Providing Blaylock wasn't on deck when they got hit, I'm guessing he'd be in either the wardroom or his quarters.
I agree.
As much as I'd love to explore, I think this is one of those discretion equals valor moments. Remy nodded.
This will take a full archaeological team and years of work.
They walked aft, their footfalls clicking dully on the deck and their murmured voices echoing off the bulkheads. They stepped through the berth deck hatch and found themselves facing another mast, this one the main. On the other side of this were a bulkhead and a ladder leading up to the main deck.
Dead end, Remy said.
Unless we want to push through to the main deck and tunnel our way aft to the wardroom. Let's call that Plan B. According to the blueprints, on the other side of this bulkhead are the coal bunkers, the upper level of the engine room, then the aft hold. The Sultan was known to deal in illicit cargo from time to time. Let's see if he made any covert adjustments to the layout. The bulkhead was 6 feet high and ran the width of the 30-foot deck. Using their headlamps, Sam and Remy scanned the bulkhead from one side to the other. Directly below the spot where the ladder pierced the deck above, Remy spotted a quarter-sized indentation in one of the planks. She pressed her thumb into it and was rewarded with a snick. A hinged hatch swung downward. Sam caught it, then lowered it the rest of the way. On tiptoes, he peered into the opening.
A crawl space, he said. It's heading in the right direction.
Sam boosted Remy through the hatch, then chinned himself up and followed. They headed aft, knees and hands bumping along the wood.
We're over the coal bunkers, I think, Sam said.
10 more feet, and Remy said, bulkhead coming up. They stopped. The sound of Remy's fingers tapping and probing the bulkhead filled the crawl space.
Snick.
Eureka, she said. Another hatch. She crawled through this opening and disappeared. Sam heard the clang of her feet hitting grated steel. He crawled to the hatch. Directly ahead was a stanchion. He grabbed it and used it to ease himself out. They were standing on a railed catwalk. They walked to the edge and shined their headlamps down, illuminating shadowed shapes of machinery, girders, and piping. They walked along the catwalk to the aft bulkhead, where they found a short ladder leading upward to yet another hatch. Once through this hatch, they found themselves hunched over in the 4-foot-tall aft hold. Sam panned his light around, trying to orient himself. We're directly below the wardroom. There's got to be another. I found it, Remy called from a few feet away. Sam turned to see her standing before a dangling ceiling hatch. She smiled.
Crafty devil, the Sultan, she said.
Do you think this was for his harem?
I wouldn't put it past him.
Sam waddled over and formed stirrups with his hands. Up you go. Once on the deck above, they found themselves standing in a 30-foot-long corridor. At their backs was the Shenandoah's third mast, the mizzen. Along the starboard side of the corridor were 5 doors. These would be officers' quarters. Sam checked the first door.
The head, he whispered.
In turn, they checked the remaining doors. The second and third rooms were empty, but not so with the 4th and 5th. Lying face up in each of the tiered bunk beds was a skeleton.
Buried alive, Remy murmured.
My God, I wonder how long it took. However long it took, it must have been a nightmare. At the end of the corridor, they turned right through another doorway and into the port side corridor heading forward. One side was lined with more quarters. On the other, a single door led into the wardroom.
Do you want to look? Asked Sam.
Not particularly. It'll be more of the same. One more room to check, then. They turned around. A few feet aft was a thick oaken door with heavy wrought iron hinges and a matching latch handle.
Captain's quarters, Sam said.
My heart's pounding.
Mine too.
You or me? Remy asked.
Ladies first.
Sam aimed his headlamp over Remy's shoulder, helping to illuminate her path. She stepped up to the door, placed her hand on the latch, and after a moment's hesitation, depressed the thumb lever and pushed. Half expecting the cliched creak of hinges, they were surprised when the door swung noiselessly inward. From their research, they knew the captain's quarters aboard the Shenandoah measured 80 square feet, 10 feet long by 8 feet wide. Compared to the officers' berths, and especially the enlisted's bunk rooms, it was luxurious. Sam and Remy saw him at the same time. Directly ahead of him, facing the four mullioned stern windows, was a rocking chair. Jutting above the chair's headrest was a skull, bare save a few strands of whitish-yellow hair and some bits of scabrous flesh. Remy stepped across the threshold. Sam did the same. Headlamp beams focused on the figure in the chair, they paced forward, then circled around either side of the chair. Winston Blaylock was dressed as they had imagined him for the past 3 weeks. Calf-high boots, khaki pants, and a hunting jacket. Even as a skeleton, his stature was impressive. Wide shoulders, long legs, barrel chest. His hands were lying palms up in his lap. Cradled there, staring up at Sam and Remy, was a football-sized Malayo statuette, its facets sparkling green in their flashlight beams. Without a word between them, Sam gently reached down and lifted the Malayo from Blaylock's lap. They stared at the man for another full minute, then searched the cabin. They found neither a logbook nor documents, save 3 sheets of parchment. Blaylock's neat scrawl covered both sides of each sheet. Remy scanned their contents. 3 letters to Constance, she said. Dates? Sam asked. August 14, August 20th, and... Remy hesitated. The last one's dated September 16th. 3 weeks after the Shenandoah was buried here. They retraced their steps forward through the starboard corridor, down through the hatch, back through the engine room, and through the crawlspace to the berth deck. Remy climbed up through their excavated shaft, waited for Sam to secure the Malayo to the end of the rope, then hauled it up to the surface. She dropped the line back down, and Sam went up. Together they collected an armload of twigs and small branches, then built a latticework over the shaft and covered it with loam. It doesn't seem right just leaving them down there, Remy said. We'll come back, Sam replied. We'll make sure that he's taken care of. That they're all taken care of. Each lost in his or her private thoughts, the climb back up to the plateau passed quickly. 3 hours after leaving the Shenandoah, they were picking their way down the trail Sam had hacked. Remy was in the lead. Through the trees, Sam glimpsed the white sand of the beach. Their Panisi was gone. Remy, stop, Sam rasped. On instinct, he shrugged off his pack, unzipped the top pocket, grabbed the Malayo and tossed it into the brush. He donned his pack again and kept walking.
What is it?
Remy replied, turning around. She saw the expression on her husband's face. She stiffened.
What's going on?
She whispered. From somewhere to the right, hidden in the trees, came Itzley Rivera's voice.
It's called an ambush, Mrs. Fargo.
Step backward, Rivera ordered. 5 more feet and you're on the sand. Mr. Fargo, there's a rifle trained on your wife. 1 more step, Mrs. Fargo. Remy complied. Drop your pack. Remy did so. Now you come forward, Mr. Fargo. Hands up. Sam walked down the trail and stepped onto the beach. To the right, Rivera stepped from the trees. To the left, another man, armed with an assault rifle, did the same. Rivera lifted a portable radio to his mouth and said something. 10 seconds later, a speedboat glided around the peninsula and into the cove. 6 feet from the beach, it stopped. On board were 2 more men, also armed with assault rifles.
Did you find her? Rivera asked.
Sam saw no point in lying. Yes.
Was Blaylock aboard?
Yes. Sam and Remy's eyes locked. Each one was expecting the same question to come next.
Rivera said, Did you find anything interesting?
Three letters. In Spanish, Rivera barked, Search them! To the man behind Sam and Remy. He came forward, snagged each of their packs, and dragged them 10 feet away. He searched each pack and found their iPhones and their satellite phone. He crushed each one under the butt of his rifle, then kicked the pieces into the water. Finally, he frisked Sam and Remy.
Nothing, the man reported to Rivera. Just the letters.
You can have them, Rivera said.
In trade, I'm going to take your wife.
The hell you are. Sam took a step toward Rivera.
Sam, don't! Remy shouted.
The man behind Sam rushed forward and slammed the butt of his rifle into Sam's lower back, just above the kidneys. Sam stumbled forward, dropped to his knees, then climbed back to his feet. Sam took a calming breath.
Rivera, you can take you instead?
No, thank you.
He reached into his pocket, pulled out a cell phone, and tossed it to Sam.
It's prepaid and untraceable, with 3 minutes of talk time left. You've got 24 hours to determine the location of Chikomostok.
That's not enough time.
That's your problem to solve. When you've got the location, dial *69 on that phone. I'll answer. At 24 hours and 1 minute, I'll kill your wife.
Sam turned around to face Remy. He said, Everything's going to be okay, Remy. She forced a smile.
I know.
Rivera ordered, Take her. At gunpoint, Remy was marched into the water to the boat. The two men aboard lifted her over the gunwale and shoved her down into one of the rear seats. Sam turned back to Rivera, who said,
Do I have to tell you not to involve the police or any of that nonsense?
No.
Your boat is anchored on the other side of the peninsula.
I'll hunt you down.
What's that?
If you hurt her, I'll spend the rest of my life and every penny to hunt you down.
Rivera smiled thinly. I believe you'd try.